Strangely enough, when they did get back to the city, he was cheered by the sight of it. The raucous babble of thoughts and long talk spilling out from the human minds was a reassuring presence. Then there was the familiarity of the buildings and streets and canals. The way no one paid any attention to them as they walked back from the stables, not even bothering with a seclusion haze. "I'm home," he decided as the gondola took them along Grand Central Canal to the Orchard Palace. His squadmates were waiting for him in the Malfit Hall and gave him a hearty greeting. "Look at this," Maxon exclaimed, tugging at Ediard's splendid new uniform. He glanced at Christabel, who was chatting away to Cancine. "Anything to announce?" Ediard frowned. "No, we had a lovely time, and I'm certainly not giving you lot any details." Maxon and Boyd both shook their heads in despair. "Still the country boy," Maxon said sadly. "What? And have we got some news for you?" Dinlay said proudly. "What?" Ediard repeated dumbly. "After the ceremony," Cancine taunted, "it needs time to explain." "Come on," Maxon said. "We'd better grab our seats while we still can." At Ediard's graduation ceremony, the block of seats had taken up less than a fifth of the available floor space. Today, some families who'd come to watch their sons and daughters graduate had to stand around the walls. As before, Mayor Owen appeared at the top of the grand stairs, flanked by the district masters and the guild masters. As they descended to the floor, the giant roof above displayed Quarentia's sister planets drifting through another exquisite dawn of wispy, gold-tinged clouds. Owen began his little speech on the makeshift platform. Ediard, who was near the back of the hall, looked along the line of masters behind the mayor. This time they all looked attentive, as if gauging the mood of the audience. Their tenseness was a contrast to the excitement and satisfaction of the new constables and their families. Then he saw Bice, whose long face was rigid with animosity. He was staring directly back at Ediard. For a second, Ediard was taken aback by the loathing he saw and sensed. He composed himself and matched the master's hostility with cool indifference. Loud applause broke out as the first probationer stepped up to the platform, and Owen awarded him his epaulets. Ediard applauded politely throughout the ceremony, which lasted a long time. The only time he clapped with genuine enthusiasm was when the probationers from Jeevan Station received their epaulets. Young Felax glowed with pride as he hurried back down the steps, holding the small bronze buttons aloft so his parents could see. Ediard and Dinlay shared a grin at that. "Oh, lady," Dinlay groaned, "was I like that?" "I don't know. I was too busy trying not to trip down the stairs." On the row behind them, Che leaned forwards. "You were both an embarrassment," he assured them. Ediard knew he was expected to participate in the reception that followed. Not so many months ago, the very idea would have filled him with dread. Now, after all he'd been through, he didn't care anymore. Besides, Christabel was on his arm the whole time, smiling and impressing people a lot more than he did. So he took a wine glass from a G-chimp, refused the canapes, put on his best smile, sealed up his mind, and started to tell parents how wonderful their newly qualified constables were, and how glad he was that they'd be helping him. And yes, he did think the gangs would ultimately be defeated. And no, he couldn't give a timescale, it was confidential. And yes, they did have a way to finish the exclusion campaign, and please urge your district master and representative to support the warrants. "We're splitting into political groups," Christabel whispered into his ear an hour into the party. "How very Macathran of us." Ediard scanned round with his farsight. She was right. Three distinct groups of masters had collected on the Malfit Hall's black floor. One led by Finnetan, who was all smiles and enthusiasm, with district masters who joined the exclusion campaign. Most vociferous among them was Julin, who was almost unrecognizable as the broken man of the Festival of Guidance. His enthusiasm was sweeping people along as he greeted families to congratulate them. They weren't used to talking to district masters, let alone one so effusive and pleasant. "Your father is a talented politician," Ediard observed. "Try and say that as if it was a good thing." Her third hand pinched him sharply on his buttock. Etiard resisted the impulse to return the jab. Finnerton caught his eye and smiled approvingly at Christabel before turning back to the head of the Fiacre Pottery Association, whose third daughter had just received her epaulets. There were another 8 district masters in their group, representing Jevons, Silvarum, Zelda, Droop, Tosella, Lilylight, Ilongo, and Padua. Finnerton also had the masters for Vaji, Kobara, and Maiko in his orbit, where they were being assiduously courted for their support. The biggest group, clustering together in the middle of the hall, were the undecided, still the majority of districts. Then there were those who formed a picket around Owen, the most traditional families, Etiard noted, with Bice at their center. They too were glad-handing, chatting happily with the new constables. He was rather perturbed to see the Pythia was among them. Surely she could see the exclusion warrants needed to be extended. Then he remembered she had gently refused to prohibit anyone from entering Erie. It had been reasonable enough. People should be allowed to attend the ladies' church. "This division isn't good," he said to Christabel as the guests started to leave. "Macathran needs to be united if we're to defeat the gangs." "Quite." She led him over to Finnerton and her father.
"Welcome back," Julian said.
He embraced his daughter, then shook hands with Etiard. There was a slight pause when he looked at Etiard, as if expecting something. Finnerton, too, seemed to be waiting. Etiard wasn't sure what to say.
"Right then," Finnerton said. "This is as good a time as any. Etiard, while you and Christabel were away, we've been pressuring the remaining district masters and representatives to join the exclusion warrants scheme. Sadly, to little avail. The mayor has been equally effusive in opposition to it."
"But why?" Etiard asked.
"Because, as he rightly points out, we have no conclusion, no final answer as to what to do with these people."
"I do," Etiard said, feeling confident after everything he and Christabel had talked about.
"You do?"
Finnerton asked.
"Yes, sir. The only thing we can do. Banishment."
"Ah, that's a bold statement, young Etiard."
He grinned sheepishly at Christabel. "It was pointed out to me that, although it sounds drastic, the actual numbers of people we need to get rid of are tiny in relation to the city's overall population." Finnerton and Julian exchanged a look.
"That makes this easier, then," Finnerton said. "It's quite plain that Owen is going to steer this into another clash in council, and delaying tactics will work in his favor. We need to grab the initiative back from him, and proposing banishment is exactly the kind of prospect that will galvanize people into supporting us."
Etiard glanced over at the masters gathered around Owen. "I don't understand. I expected it would make things worse in council."
"It will," Finnerton said with a smile. "And we can capitalize on that division."
"Ah," Christabel said. She nodded in understanding. "Of course."
"Of course what?" Etiard said.
"I am going to announce my candidature for mayor," Finnerton said, "and banishing the gangs will be my campaign pledge to the people of Macathran."
"What did he say?" Boyd asked as the squad made its way back to Jevon Station after the ceremony. "That he's going to run for mayor," Etiard told them all. He was still taken aback by the notion, though the excitement was growing. With Finnerton in charge, so many things can change. "There'll be a party in the Blue Tower tonight so he can make a public announcement."
"Not Finnerton, you arse," Maxon snapped. "Master Julian."
"Julian? He didn't say anything. But with his support, Finnerton stands a real chance."
"All right," Cancine said. "Forget that. What did you say?"
"I said that I'd support him in any way I could." They all gave each other puzzled looks. Etiard could sense their minds closing against him, but not before several traces of irritation and disappointment were manifested. He guessed taking a week off had annoyed them more than he'd realized at the time.
"Okay, then. At least we've been busy," Dinley said, as they passed through the station's main gate. "Unfortunately, so have the gangs. The gondoliers pulled another body from the canal last Thursday, the second son of a cloth merchant from Igadi district."
"Lady,"
Etiard groaned. It didn't take them long to regain their courage. They settled in the small hall. Dinlay's third hand shut the doors behind them. Cancine sat down on one of the tables, her boots resting on a bench. Maxon directed a G-chimp to fetch some water. "That was very cheap wine at the party," he complained as he gulped down several mouthfuls from a glass tankard. Dinlay pulled a bench over to sit opposite Ediard. His face was exhibiting a great deal of contentment. Boyd sat next to him, trying not to show too much amusement at his squadmate's attitude. "So what did the second son do to annoy the gangs?" Ediard asked. "Nothing," Dinlay said. "They're using a variant on the old extortion racket." "A clever one," Maxon said, finishing his second tankard of water. "They're not bothering with small shops and stalls anymore," Dinlay explained. "They've moved up a social class to target the smaller merchants, and they don't ask for money. They want a share of the business itself." "It's a route to legitimacy," Cancine said. "If you've got a warehouse full of stock, someone comes along and asks if they can buy a share in your venture. But the thing is, they want to defer payment for that percentage." "It'll come out of increased profits, is what they usually say," Boyd said. "So far, nothing criminal. Certainly nothing you can use to complain to the constables or courts." "Except you know who it is and what they're asking," Dinlay continued. "They make that very clear. If you don't comply, then a family member gets hurt." "Or in some cases murdered," Maxon said, "as with the cloth merchant's son, which is extreme, but those are the cases we get to hear about." "So we don't know how widespread it is," Ediard said. "No, but everyone is complaining about how prices are creeping up, and there's no reason. There's no shortage of anything. The port is crowded with ships delivering cargo, and the city's warehouses are full. The lower and middle level of merchants don't have the kind of protective associations which shops and small traders have," Cancine said. "Their commercial rivalry precludes almost all cooperation." "But they have personal guards," Ediard said. "No, they don't," Dinlay said. "Oh, the patriarch will have some tufts with him when he collects large payments from clients, or pays a ship's captain. But we're not talking about the kind of small army which the grand families employ here. These merchants have large families who are completely unprotected, and they're a vital part of Macathran's economy." "I see," Ediard said. He had hoped for a brief respite after he got back, but he should have known better. "So we need to identify who..." "No, we don't," Dinlay said merrily. "We don't." "Already done it." "Ah." Now a lot of the squad's attitude became clearer to Ediard. He looked round, seeing their smug faces. "So what do you need me for?" "To provide us with brute strength backup during the arrest," Maxon said with an innocent tone. Ediard laughed. "Tell me." "First the bad news," Boyd said. "The House of Blue Petals has a new owner." "Who?" Ediard asked sharply. Boyd gave Dinlay a sly glance, as if seeking approval. "Buati." "Never heard of him." "Nobody had," Boyd said. "Turns out he's Ivar's half-brother."
"Oh, great."
"Would you like the bad news now?" Maxon asked.
Ediard gave him a brusque stare.
"Rumor has it that Buati has a partner."
"Go on."
"Ranali."
Ediard dropped his face into his hands and chuckled softly. "I should have seen that coming, especially after Tanal teamed up with Ivar that night."
"Ediard?" Cancine queried.
"Actually, that's good news," he told them.
"It is?"
"We finally have a link between the gangs and a grand family. Can we prove she's the partner?"
"The occupancy deed is filed at the city registry," Dinlay said, taking off his glasses to give them a polish. "It's considered privileged unless a crime has been committed either on the premises or by the owner. We could lodge a request in the lower courts to view it, but all it tells us is who's claimed residence rights to the structure, and as we know Buate is family, it won't tell us anything new. And the articles of corporation governing the Blue Petals business will be held by the Guild of Tax Clerks. However, the nature of the business means the arrangement with Ranali isn't likely to be written down anywhere."
"So it's just hearsay?"
Dinlay shrugged.
"Yes."
"And this is what you managed to discover while I was away?"
"As my soon-to-be father says, everyone's a critic," Maxon said with mock dismay. "No, actually,
We have been doing difficult observation work under dangerous conditions for little pay and scant thanks from our corporal and station captain. For the love of the lady, will you tell me what is going on? We followed several gang members who are covered by exclusion warrants, with good reason. One of them was a member of an enforcer crew, Dinlay said, grinning broadly. They've just told a merchant called Chariao in Neff that they want a third of his business. He imports sal sponge.
What the heck is sal sponge?
Edyard demanded. And I swear on the lady, if just one of you gives me that pitying look over this, I will dump the lot of you headfirst in Birmingham Pool and hold you under.
Boyd opened his mouth ready to explain. A frown creased his forehead and he turned to Maxen. Maxen pursed his lips and gave Cancine an inquisitive stare.
Well, don't ask me, she said. I've never heard of it before.
It must be valuable, Dinlay mused. Chariao has a big family, who dress in fine clothes and carouse all over the city, and there's also two mistresses he covers in jewellery.
Did he agree to their terms? Edyard said.
No, Boyd said. The lady blessed him with a backbone and a lot of pompous bluster. He refused. So we followed the enforcer crew home to Sampaloc.
You went into Sampaloc? Edyard asked in surprise.
Like I said, difficult and dangerous, Maxin announced portentously. Which is why we know that they're going to kick the crap out of Rapsail, Chariao's firstborn, as the first warning, and they're going to do it tonight.
Where? Edyard asked eagerly.
Ryan Street was a sinuous pathway on the northernmost corner of Abad, linking the Roseway Canal to the Great Major Canal. The buildings which made up its walls were all tall and imposing, though one of them did incline outwards, allowing broad strands of unkempt gurkvine to dangle down from the eaves like a living partition along the street. It was the building next to the overhanging vegetation which housed the Reckless Colonel, a restaurant and theatre of good repute, where the wealthier sons of the city's gentlemen congregated for a pleasurable night among their own. Good expensive food was to be found on the starched white linen cloths of its hexagonal tables. The cellar was stocked with an enviable selection of vintage wines from across Querentia. The lounge area offered deep and cosy chairs and settees, while the dancers who graced the stage performed their elegant moves with amazing agility to the pitch-perfect house band. Five large doormen stood outside the glossy wooden doors, physically and telekinetically strong, their presence alone enough to deter anyone foolish enough to be born beneath a certain status in life. It was after 2 o'clock in the morning when one of them tipped his tall peaked hat to Rapsail, who tottered unsteadily down the three awkward steps to the pavement. A heavy rain was lashing the street, dimming the orange lights shining down from the building walls. Rapsail tightened his leather cloak around his long blue and scarlet jacket as he grunted his inebriated good night to the doormen and began to weave an unsteady route towards the Great Major Canal. Alcohol suppressed his farsight as much as it did his optical focus. He had no awareness of the five men lurking in the deeper shadows and alleys off Ryan Street, nor did he notice as they emerged from their secluded refuges to walk both behind and alongside him. It was only as they started to close in that he frowned with intoxicated confusion.
"I say, hello, you fellows," he slurred.
A third hand closed around his ankles. For a moment his legs moved sluggishly, then he peered down at his immobile feet. Rapsail blinked down at his polished leather shoes with their fashionable brass and silver buckles. They didn't seem to be doing what he wanted, which was to get him far, far away from this place.
"I say, that's off!"
One of his assailants laughed. They circled him now, dark spectres with hoods pulled over their heads, faces shadowed and wreathed with a seclusion haze. Rain pattered heavily on their oilskin cloaks to form quick rivulets over the fabric.
"What do you want?"
Rapsail's instinctive self-preservation was starting to get through his alcohol-saturated brain. He tried to long shout, but that required too much concentration. A hand tugged his hood away from his head.
"I warn you, I have friends in this city, powerful friends."
"This is a message for your father,"
Medath, the enforcer crew's leader, said.
"What message?"
Rapsail asked as the rain slicked down his hair.
"He'll understand."
A fist slammed into Raspail's podgy stomach. The young man doubled up immediately, falling to his knees. Tears of pain mingled with the rain on his cheeks.
Oh, sweet lady, no. I have money. Please.
It's not your cash we want, Medath explained patiently. It's your inheritance.
Two of the men pulled leather-weighted coshes from under their cloaks, while two more used their third hands to pinion Rapsail in his cowed position.
After all, Medath said reasonably, you won't be needing it. Cripples don't have anything to spend it on.
Rapsail whimpered piteously.
Damage him, Medath ordered. Badly.
Two koshes were raised into the air, slick with water. They kept on rising, pulled out of grasping fingers to whirl away into the night. Both men grunted in surprise. Medath fell into a crouch, long blade sliding into his hands. He scanned round with his farsight, probing every doorway and alcove along the streets as his telekinetic shield hardened. One of the other enforcers aimed a kick at Rapsail's head. His boot was yanked backwards, sending him crashing down. There was a sickening slap as his face smacked flat onto the pavement. He yelled, "Help me!" through the blood pouring out of his mouth and nose, then froze in terror as he was tugged violently across the pavement. He slid away from his comrades at frightening speed, hands scrabbling at the wet surface to no effect. His shrieks were cut off as he vanished round the corner.
"Dear lady!"
another gasped. He started to run. His feet left the ground and he was propelled through the air to crash into the nearest wall. He crumpled to the ground, stunned. The remaining three enforcers closed together. Medath kept his blades held ready. The others drew pistols. Laughter echoed down the street. It was too much for one. He fired at a clutch of shadows. The bullet stopped a mere couple of feet from his pistol muzzle, hanging in midair. Raindrops curved neatly around it.
Water walker, Medath breathed.
Good evening. Ediard walked forward, his body becoming visible amid the wavering shadows and unceasing rain, as he reached the middle of the street. Then rain avoided him, parting above his head to leave his splendid new tunic perfectly dry. Behind him, Cansine and Dinley emerged from nowhere. You're under arrest, Ediard said. He extended a hand, and the two pistols were wrenched out of their owner's fingers. Cuff them, he told Dinley. He turned to Cansine. Get the knives. Medath watched her approach. He rotated the blade skillfully and proffered the handles towards her. Ediard was walking towards the enforcer who'd been flung against the wall, bending over as the man groaned weakly.
I'll take those, Cansine said, and held out a hand for the knives.
It was Medath's one chance. He sent them flying towards her with a vigorous flick of his wrists. At the same time, he shoved his third hand against Ediard with his full strength.
Fight them! He bellowed at his two accomplices.
Cansine stumbled as she warded off the knives, tumbling onto the pavement. Dinley was grappling with one of the enforcers, while Ediard came to his aid, swiftly restraining the second with a resolute telekinetic grip. By the time they'd got both of them subdued and cuffed, Medath had sprinted away. Ediard's farsight followed him charging over the iron bridge just above Midpool. Maxen and Boyd cast off their concealment. Boyd had the unconscious first enforcer slung over his shoulder. Maxen hurried over to Cansine and helped her to her feet.
Well, that was humiliating, she said as she tried to brush water off her uniform trousers.
He believed it, Ediard said. His farsight showed him Medath was over the bridge and into Foles Park. For a real tough guy, he can run very fast, Boyd observed in amusement. Ediard turned to the man he'd cuffed. Hold your arms out, Centen.
You know my name.
Of course I know your name. I know your house. I know what you ate for lunch, your girlfriend, your three children who've got themselves proper jobs. Now hold your arms out.
What are you going to do?
Ediard used his third hand to pull Centen's arms up. The man flinched at the force.
Please, he implored. I'll stop this. By the lady, I will.
No, you won't, Ediard said. He slipped the key into the cuffs and unlocked them. Centen gave him a frightened look. I'm not arresting you, Ediard said. Any of you.
Please, Waterwalker. Please, no, don't kill me.
Shut up.
I'm tired of wasting my time in court with people like you. So this is what you're going to do.
Leave.
I... What? Senten gasped.
You and your friends are going to leave Macathran tonight. Now, my squad will escort you to the south gate. You will walk through it, and you will not come back.
Where will I go?
Ediard leaned forward, putting his face an inch from Sentan. What do your victims do after you've beaten them? After you've snapped their bones and made their blood run over the floor of their homes, while their children are made to watch? After they've been carried off screaming in pain to the hospital? They get on with their lives as best they can. Do you understand me now?
Yes.
If you come back, if you set foot in my city again, I will know. Do you believe that? Do you believe me?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Then go. Senten bowed his head in defeat. Ediard went over to Rapsail, who was still kneeling on the ground. He was a mess, his trousers soaking wet, hair plastered against his head, cloak in disarray.
Thank you, he sobbed. Thank you, Water Walker.
Get up, Ediard told him without sympathy. Behind him, Dinlay and Maxon were sorting out the crowd enforcer crew, moving them down the street on the start of their journey out of the city. Rapsail managed to clamber to his feet and stood swaying as the rain continued to lash against him. Ediard made an effort to calm down. He was sworn to protect Macathran's ordinary citizens, but people like Rapsail made it difficult to feel any empathy for his kind. There's a reason you were picked on tonight, Ediard said coldly. Your father didn't come to us, to me, when Medath's friends gave him their ultimatum. If I don't know what the gangs are up to, I cannot protect you from them. Tonight you were lucky, and for that you are in debt to my squad.
Of course, Rapsail said. Father will pay you handsomely for your services. We are gentlemen of honor.
I do not want money, Ediard ground out. Rapsail was sobering fast. Even in his befuddled state he could see Ediard's anger. Of course not. I apologize profusely, Water Walker. What do you want?
Information.
Your family is not the only one they have come visiting. Tomorrow, when you have sobered up, I will visit you and your father, and we will discuss how the constables can remove the gang's influence from your fellow merchants.
Yes, yes, of course.
Ediard beckoned Cancine over. Get him back home in one piece. Tell his father I'll be there in the morning.
I've really got the good duties tonight, haven't I?
Ediard grinned awkwardly. You did well. I know that wasn't easy for you.
Thank you.
Huh. But she couldn't help a small flash of gratification from leaking out. Come on, sir, she said, and took a grip on Rapsail's shoulder.
I say, a girl, constable.
Yes, sir.
And a jolly pretty one, too.
Ediard and Boyd drew in a sharp breath together, wincing, but Cancine allowed Rapsail to continue living.
Let me come with you, Ediard, Boyd said as the unlikely pair walked away. Please.
I can handle this.
They nearly killed you last time.
I was trying not to cause a fuss then. I think we all know those days are behind us now. Boyd gave him a very skeptical stare.
All right.
I need you to go back to the Reckless Colonel. Somebody there was long talking directly to the enforcer crew. Make it clear to the owner. He's now on my shit list. I want his full cooperation from now on. And see if you can turn the informer as well.
Lady, is that all?
We all have different abilities. That's what makes us good as a team.
All right, but just be careful.
All I'm going to do is introduce myself.
What if Ranelagh's there?
The lady isn't that cruel, is she?
Ediard had stayed out of Myco ever since the night of the fire. He knew he was physically capable of protecting himself from anything Ivarl and his lieutenants could throw at him. What he lacked was motivation. He hadn't quite lost his nerve as far as confronting Ivarl, or his replacement, was concerned. It was just that he needed time to restore his confidence. The kidnapping and Christabel had done that. Ediard slid up smoothly and silently through the city-altered floor into the lounge of the House of Blue Petals, to find it nearly deserted. The doors were closed and locked. Two drunks were snoring on couches, with blankets thrown over them by considerate staff. Three G-monkeys and a couple of tired stewards were busy in the room at the back,
washing the last of the glasses. The fires in the iron stoves had sunk to a cozy red glimmer. He took a good look round. The furniture was similar to last time, though it was all new, of course. Even the piano looked the same. There were no globes full of oil, or any other container for that matter. No beagle, either. Edyard shed his concealment and walked up the stairs to the gallery. Several of the rooms were still occupied by girls and their clients. The madam and two doormen were sitting in a small parlour, eating a very late supper as they waited for the girls to finish. It felt strange to be visible as he walked along the corridors and upstairs where, before, he had always crept about like a nervous ghost. As he approached the long room on the third floor which Ivar used to hold court in, the door swung open for him, pulled by someone's third hand. Edyard walked through.
"I wondered when you'd pay me a visit," Buate said.
That he and Ivar shared a parent wasn't in question. Edyard guessed it must be their father. He had the same broad forehead and strange green eyes. But where Ivar's powerful frame had started to inflate, Buate was slim and muscled, as if he'd spent his life doing hard physical work. He was also younger than his half-brother, probably no more than 70, with luxuriant black hair arranged in trim ringlets that hung below his collar, a fashion that was current amid the grand families in the city's northern districts. As was the expensive gold-embroidered leather waistcoat that he'd left unbuttoned to reveal a vivid scarlet shirt. His jewellery was more discreet than Ivar's, a couple of gold bands on his fingers and one diamond stud earring. A very large diamond, Edyard noted. Buate was sitting behind the desk, gazing at his visitor with aristocratic contempt. Unlike Ivar, who had always kept the office tidy, there were papers and legal scrolls scattered everywhere. As if to counter the difference, Nanit was there as before, sitting on a broad velvet-covered couch to one side of the desk. Above her gauzy skirt, she wore a strange narrow corset of leather straps that looked uncomfortably tight. She gave Edyard a blank stare, her mind perfectly shielded. Edyard used his third hand to close the door. "It will only be the one visit," he said, deliberately ignoring Nanit, though there might have been a bruise on her cheek. The light was too poor for him to be sure. This kind of visit, anyway. Buate picked up a silver stiletto, playing with it absently. "And what is this kind of visit, Water Walker?"
"A friendly one."
"Indeed. What kind of friendship do you imagine we could have?"
"Brief."
Buate laughed. "I see why my dear brother enjoyed you as his sparring partner.
I don't remember seeing you at the funeral."
"I was busy in the provinces. I only returned to Macathran after I heard the sad news."
"Do you know who killed him?"
"I thought he drowned."
"No. He was dead long before he hit the water. Torture tends to do that."
"That's awful. I trust you're busy finding the criminals who did this."
"That's one of the reasons I'm here."
"Ah, how interesting.
Did you hear Grandmaster Finnerton has declared his candidacy for mayor?"
"It was the talk of the house tonight."
"His campaign will be centered on banishment."
"Yes, so I heard. I'm afraid he won't be getting my vote. Too many of my friends would suffer under such a policy."
"That's why you need to lead them away." Boate's detached amusement faltered.
"Excuse me."
"I want you to go now. Leave the city. Take your colleagues and your business associates and your lieutenants with you. This way you'll be able to leave with most of your money. You can live a good life in exile."
"Normally I just laugh at something so preposterous. But I can see you're actually being serious."
"A lot of people are going to get hurt over the next few months. There will be deaths. You can avoid that. Think of this as an appeal to your better nature."
"You believe I have one?"
"I think you're smarter than your dead brother. He was a jumped-up thug, using equally stupid muscle against small fry. But now you're here, and I see things are already changing. The gangs are targeting merchants and larger businesses now. You're trying to integrate yourself deeper within the city's economy and submerge yourself from legal challenge. That takes a more methodical mind." He reached out with his third hand and aggravated a whole ream of paperwork on the desk, sending the sheets fluttering across the floor. Nanit scrambled to pick up those that fell across her and the couch.
the mind of someone who appreciates paperwork. Boite dropped the stiletto and watched the swarm of paper with disapproval. Please don't do that. Ediard sent a last flurry of papers chasing up towards the high ceiling. A smart legal mind. And I've grown to dislike lawyers. I have no idea what you're talking about. I am not acquiring businesses, nor have I any desire to. The House of Blue Petals provides a more than adequate income. Ediard heard loud footsteps pounding along the corridor outside. He cocked his head to one side and gave Boite an expectant look.
Boss!
A man yelled. The doors burst open. A very out-of-breath Medath came charging in, his oilskin cloak scattering water on the polished floor behind him.
Boss! Boss! The water walker was there! He caught us with Rapsail and... Ah!
Medath nearly fell over backwards in fright. He clutched at his heart, eyes bugging as he drew a juddering breath. Boite was actually trembling in anger as he glared at his enforcer. Ediard smiled contentedly.
Timing is everything in our line of work, don't you find?
You can't be here, Medath cried. You're back there.
His finger pointed madly out towards the city.
I ran.
Boss? Shut up.
Ediard made his smile vanish. Leave the city. Take this cretin and all the others like him with you. You cannot win. Not against me. Boite rose from the chair, his hands pressed, palms down on the desk.
You understand nothing. Go back to your countryside, boy, before you and everyone you love gets hurt. This city is not for you.
They stared at each other as Medath continued to pant loudly behind them. Macathran is already mine, Ediard said. You have no idea what I'm capable of. He turned and started to walk for the door.
You're as weak as my brother, Boite spat after him. Next time it won't be Manartha who gets taken.
Ediard spun round, flinging an arm out. Boite was torn from his seat to smash against the wall between two of the oval windows. He squirmed impotently, 7 feet above the floor. Thin worms of dazzling static crackled in the air around him, jabbing down at his clothes. Boite wailed in dread as tiny puffs of smoke squirted out of each strike point.
If anything ever happens to her or any of my friends, you will join your brother in a manner that will make his passing seem a delight.
Ediard abruptly withdrew his third hand. Boite fell to the floor, landing badly on his shoulder. He grunted savagely at the pain.
You keep bad company, Ediard told Nanit, and closed the doors behind him.
Ediard woke alone in his maisonette. His G-chimps bustled round getting breakfast ready as he walked down the steps into his pool. For all the fun Christabel and he had sponging each other down in the beach house, he'd missed the sheer luxury of the bathing pool with its perfect temperature. At first he thought that might account for his melancholia. Then he acknowledged he just missed not waking up with Christabel. As he munched his way through the mix of nuts and fruit which the G-chimps had prepared, he wondered if he should long talk her. It would be nice to find out when they could actually meet up next. Yesterday had been so ridiculously busy. He was sure that she would expect him to go to the Culverit mansion and be with her to spend a night together, even though they'd be a lot comfier in the maisonette with his modified bed and the other simple comforts he'd created. Then he paused with a glass of apple and mango juice halfway to his mouth. Of all the family girls he'd been with, everyone had been brought back to the maisonette, excepting the occasional night spent in an inn's room or that nightmare weekend with Ranelagh. Not once had he been taken back to their bedroom at the family residence.
Has Boyd ever gone back to Soraya's mansion for a night? I can't remember.
Lady,
I wish I understood these kind of customs better.
The grand families could get quite stuffy about formalities. I'll ask Cancine. She'll tell me. Until then he forswore off long-talking Christabel. Of course, if she were to call him.
Maxon was waiting by the gates at the tenement's entrance. How did it go last night? He asked.
Not too good. Boite wasn't inclined to leave, Macathran.
I could have told you that.
I knew it myself, but I had to put it to him. Maxon grinned.
Your conscience, it'll be the death of us.
Most likely. But you should have seen Medath's face. It was worth 10 times the risk just for that. So how did your part go?
Sentan and the rest of them trudged off down the south road. Quite a picture it was. We stayed by the gate for over an hour and sent a jeagle out to watch, but they never came back.
Ah well, 4 down, 400 to go.
We can't do this 4 at a time. Besides, it took us 5 days' hard work just to uncover this one scheme.
I know. We just have to hold the line until Finnerton gets elected.
You really think he will?
He has to, Ediard said earnestly. Most people in the city want the gangs expelled. Owen doesn't stand a chance.
You don't know that. He could pull out a policy that will be even more popular.
If he wanted to be that popular, he'd enact banishment right now and stop trying to wreck our exclusion warrants campaign. The politicians in this city are a lot smarter and more devious than you give them credit for. You'll see.
Ediard didn't believe him. He knew Finnerton would win. They reached Arrival Canal and went along to the first mooring platform to hail a gondola.
At least we get to see Rapsail's hangover, Maxon said.
The meeting with Rapsail and Chariao was awkward and stilted. Chariao was torn between gratitude to the constables and fury at himself and Rapsail. Rapsail especially came off badly. Waster, parasite, worthless were some of the more frequently used words. But Ediard was now quite accomplished at talking round reluctant citizens, especially important ones, or those who considered themselves important. It wasn't Chariu's self-directed fury Ediard manipulated. It was the anger and fear the merchant felt towards the gangs who had come so close to taking his life's accomplishments away from him. In the end, there wasn't that much to exploit. The whole experience meant that Chariao had undergone an almost evangelical conversion. Neff was going to get its first merchants' association. Of that, he swore on the lady's life. He was going to compel his friends and rivals. There were old favors he would call in, he promised, social ties he could use, even financial debts. Together, Neff's merchants would stand against the gangs and this insidious new strategy. Everything he learned would immediately be delivered to the constables. By Rapsail.
Ediard walked into the small hall at the Jeevan station in an exceptionally fine mood. Several probationary constables had delivered names that their station captains wanted adding to the exclusion lists, which he passed on to Ural's team for checking. They did that as a matter of course now, making sure the names were genuine. Several traders and shopkeepers had also forwarded people they suspected. Ediard sent runners to the relevant constable stations, asking that the new suspects be observed. 3 new warrants needed drawing up by the Lawyers Guild, producing 9 copies each, which he'd then have to humbly ask the district masters and representatives to sign.
I wish we could just have 1 warrant to cover all the districts, Boyd complained.
After Finnerton gets elected, Ediard promised. But I did have 1 idea after I saw Boate last night. If the gangs are taking shares in legitimate businesses, it'll entail a lot of paperwork. Droal, how do we get the Guild of Tax Clerks to investigate someone we suspect of cheating on taxes?
Get an inspector appointed to review the case. Dinley, can you organize that?
Dinley smiled. My pleasure. Talk to the Myco station captain as well. The inspector should be given a constable's escort while he's in Boate's office. I don't want them intimidated.
Leave it with me.
That should leave Boate with a large annoyance, Ediard said in satisfaction.
If he's as smart as you say, he'll have accountants who can face up to a tax inspector, Maxon said.
Yes, but it will cost him time and money. I want to open up as many angles of attack as we can.
Ediard turned to his own paperwork that was piled up on a couple of the benches. There were actually more sheets and scrolls than he'd seen in Boate's office. He hadn't realized how clerk-like this battle was going to become. All he truly wanted was to be out on the streets arresting criminals.
Any gang activities we can smack down today? He asked hopefully.
Some interesting talk coming out of the Alongo Stallholders Association, Maxon said. I'm going to follow that up this afternoon.
Good, Ediard said. He wondered if Cristobal was having lunch right now. If so, it would be on the Hortus on their mansion's 10th level. A long table with a white awning, fluttering idly overhead.
Family and friends gathered to chatter and laugh with Macathran as their backdrop, wine to drink, tasty food to eat. Then an afternoon spent shopping or at a spa bath, where they would prepare for this evening's parties. He picked up a piece of paper from the newest pile. It was a report from the Lilylight station about attempts by gang members named in the exclusion warrants to infiltrate the district and menace their old haunts again. Their methods were becoming quite sophisticated, distracting bridge guards, disguising themselves. The small hall's doors shut as the squad went out to lunch. Edyard looked up, realizing just he and Cancine were left. She was giving him a concerned look, which worried him. "Do you want to talk about it?" she asked. Look, I asked you to tackle Medath because he'd believe he could overcome you. I knew he can't." Her lips came together reproachfully. "I'm talking about your week with Christabel." "What's about it?" He suddenly realized that being here alone with her wasn't an accident. "Edyard, please, the two of us." She gave him a compassionate smile. "There's a way we are closer than the others. I still almost think it's a shame you and I didn't happen, but well, now." "I know, and I'm happy for the two of you. He needs someone like you. It's a perfect match, and I haven't told anyone." "Edyard, this isn't about me. I'm here as a friend asking if I can help. Why didn't it work out? I mean, be honest, it's not that you lack experience as a lover now, is it? There have been enough girls these last months." He knew he was blushing. Yes, Cancine was a friend, a very good one, especially after, well, anyway, he wasn't used to talking about such things with her. The others, yes, that was boys' talk, not that they ever went into real detail. "Nothing was wrong, thank you," he said stiffly. "Not in any way." Cancine stared at him as if she was trying to figure out a major puzzle. It was almost as if she was angry with him. Then her expression suddenly changed to one of surprise, then dismay. Her hand went to her mouth. "Oh no, no!" It was as if she was beseeching him to say anything else. "What?" he asked apprehensively. "Edyard," she stood in front of him and took both his hands in hers. "You do understand what last week was, don't you?" "Yes. If you must know, I had the most wonderful time of my life. It was a miracle I ever came back to Macathran. Satisfied now?" "A week and the day," she said as if it were some kind of test. "Which day?" "Oh, lady, you really don't know." Cancine tightened her grip. "Edyard, a Macathran girl of good family, particularly one in Christabel's position, invites a man to spend 1 week outside the city with her for one reason. So they can both find out if they are compatible in bed. If you are going to spend the next 200 years together, you really, seriously, need to know that before you start." 200 years? Edyard's legs were somehow unsteady. The feeling of dread that was creeping over his entire body was horrifyingly similar to that time when he'd woken in Ashwell to discover the bandits. "What 200 years?
"Marriage, you nincompoop. Oh, Edyard."
Cancine was mortified. She let go of him and crammed her hands against her forehead. "If your week worked out that way, you are supposed to ask her father for her hand in marriage the day you return. That's the custom. A week and the day." "Oh, dear lady, this isn't happening."
"There was nothing wrong, was there? You just didn't know. Christabel thinks we're getting married."
He sat down heavily. "She was expecting you to ask. Everyone was. We were all worried for you that it had gone wrong."
"Oh, lady.
Wait, who else knows? Because this is Macathran, and everything is in public." Now Cancine looked really upset. Well, there have been a few people speculating who was the one with the problem. A few? He knew all too well what that meant. The whole lady damned city is talking about it.
"She must hate me,"
he said in an aghast whisper. "Not Christabel. Not her angry with me. I can't stand that."
"No. Look, I'd better go over to Haxben and explain."
"No!" Edyard sent his farsight surging into the culverted ziggurat.
He found her easily enough in her grandiose bedroom, curled up on the bed, her mind a low glimmer of pure misery. Little Menatha was in there too, not saying anything, just miserable on behalf of her beloved elder sister. In the corridors outside, servants mooched about, sullen and trepidatious. Julian sat in one of the day lounges, trying to radiate a composed persona, but he couldn't help the distress he felt inside from leaking through, the concern for his daughter.
"Oh, lady," Edyard groaned in disbelief. "I am such an idiot."
"You didn't know," Cancine repeated. He shook his head, banishing the small hall from his mind. "Christabel?" his directed long talk asked gently. On the bed she tensed, then curled up tighter. Her mind's strongest shield tightened round her thoughts.
"Christabel, please. I'm so sorry."
It was no use. She was completely closed to him.
"Fuck!"
He smashed his fist down on the bench, unconsciously putting his telekinetic strength behind it. The ancient wood splintered with an almighty crack. Both halves of the bench hit the ground. A small sea of paperwork skidded down onto the floor. He stood up. "I'm going to see her."
"I'm not sure that's a good..."
"My mistake," he was almost shouting now. "I will put this right. I have to."
"Edyard?"
The gentleness of her tone caught him by surprise. She put her arms round him and kissed his brow.
"The lady's luck be with you, Water Walker. You deserve her."
"Thanks," he said, shamefaced. "Any other customs I should know about, before I, you know?"
"Only that it's a custom, not a law. Go get her."
He perceived the two G-Eagles as soon as he stormed out of the station. They watched him carefully as he made his way over a rival canal into Silvarum. Someone was very interested in his movements, and he recognized at least one of the G-Eagles from the aviary at the ziggurat. His farsight skipped on ahead. Hormelt was standing outside the main gates, marshalling several family guards. Armed guards, in the daytime no less. The gate itself was closed and locked, as were all the other entrances into the mansion. It was Lorin who was organizing everyone, striding around the main courtyard issuing orders.
"You little shit," Edyard muttered under his breath.
Lorin was making no effort to conceal his eagerness at sealing up the vast ziggurat mansion. The constable guards on the bridge between Silverum and Haxpen gave Edyard a respectful salute as he hurried over. He returned it casually. His long talk whispered into several G-monkeys in the culverit mansion, stirring long dormant amorous thoughts that were wickedly misdirected. Five of them began to scamper across the courtyard behind the main gate, their affection for Lorin unbound. Citizens strolling along the streets outside the ziggurat heard peculiar squeaks of desire, mingling with Lorin's outraged and downright fearful yells. Agitated, frightened thoughts were broadcast wildly as clothes got torn. Servants and guards came hurrying over, adding to the physical and emotional commotion. It took several minutes for the G-monkeys to be calmed and led away. There was so much noise that even Homelt peered in to watch in bemusement as Lorin's unwelcome new suitors were coaxed back to their nests. He looked round the courtyard thoughtfully, then closed the big main gate again, trying to suppress a smile. When Lorin recovered his dignity, and a servant handed him a new cloak to cover his ripped sleeves, he cast his farsight out beyond the walls again, to no avail. The family's G-Eagles were now circling aimlessly above Birmingham Pool.
"Where is the Water Walker?"
he demanded. No one could tell him.